The title of my talk today is Revisioning Memories So We Can Liberate Happiness. So this is a truism in Buddhism, which we may forget, that deep inside of us is a happiness that's not of time, that's unconditioned, and that's waiting to burst out. When conditions are not good, when we're having a hard time, we forget that. That sukha, that's happiness in Sanskrit, is covered over by dukkha, by suffering, by anguish, by fear. More so now because there's so much ambiguity.
Take a little while to get warm in the cabin last night.
Yeah, but that's okay. It's 90 now in there.
Yeah. That was too hot.
Yeah. Some other people talking. More so now because of so much ambiguity. And then we focus on the negative and we turn it on ourselves because we have an urgent need to survive. We all want to survive. And we get on edge. We get on edge. A lot of people have been on edge the last few months, in case you haven't noticed it. The election has improved things, but how much has it improved things? Quite a bit, but still, there's so much unknown about what's going to happen. And human beings are forward-looking. We're forward-looking. And if we don't know what's going to go on, yikes. So we compromise our commitment to acting compassionately, overlooking our interdependence, overlooking that this sense of interdependence and connection is a manifestation of our innate happiness. And when we are compassionate, we tap into that happiness. So last week, Ted was talking about not naming things and how it's important sometimes to name things. Fear, when it's not named, narrows our vision. It shuts down our intuition, as well as our ability to be reflective, and it promotes violence. If we're not violent externally, we're violent internally. So what do we do on this path to uncovering deep happiness? We meditate. And we use the three-legged stool for support that I've talked about so many times. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. That sounds fancy, but all it is having someone to support you, who's a sponsor if you're a 12-step person, or a teacher or mentor if you're a Buddhist person, a Zen person. Having a Buddha, having a sponsor or a teacher or a mentor, having a community to be with, to support you, even if it's an online community. And then having Dharma, having a teaching that you can come back to the big book in 12 step. So 12 step is just as good about doing Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha as we are. They just have their own words. We need this. We need a three-legged stool. A two-legged stool is always starting to tip over. Sometimes it's okay, but then it starts to tip over. So mentors and peers to support us in naming our fears and unburdening ourselves with meditation and the support of this tool so that we can be fully present, so that we can, as I say, enlighten delusion. Dogen said, the way to attain enlightenment is through delusion. He says that's the only way to attain enlightenment, through delusion, never apart from delusion. First, we name our deluded fear. We name our deluded negative feelings. Then we relinquish a hold on our image of how things should be, how things have been, how things need to be, how things might have been. Don't you wish you'd had a better childhood? Who doesn't wish they had a better childhood? But we're just with it. We're just with it. Over and over again, we practice not resisting what is, being with what is, over and over again. Yes to what is. What choice do we have? Just being with it. It doesn't mean just bypassing our disappointments. It doesn't mean bypassing our sadness. It doesn't mean bypassing our anger about something that's happened or giving up our dreams. It means accepting both the situation and the negative feeling we might have about it. We don't need to suffer about our suffering. We just don't need to. How much of your time do you spend suffering about your suffering? Through this practice, you can let go. You'll still suffer, but you don't need to, won't suffer about it anymore. Maybe this much, but not very much. So I have a friend, an old Zen friend, she's lived in uptown for years. And about 10 years ago, she said to me, I can't stand that our neighborhood has become a shishi. It shouldn't be this way. I don't know if you guys know, uptown used to be just a regular little neighborhood with a high school and a hardware store and all that stuff, a bowling alley. She said, I can't stand it. And she said, also, people can't afford to rent in uptown anymore. That's not fair. And she ran it over for a while. I'm not blaming her. I love her. And then I saw her about 9 months ago, and she started talking to me about how crime in uptown. We never had crime before. Now we can't be safe. It went on and on and on. First, she ranted and raved about first and then the second, and then she got into bike lanes. Why does Minneapolis have all these bike lanes? People don't ride in the winter. They just do cars. And these bike lanes are on and on and on. Suffering needlessly rather than saying, this is the way things are. This is the way things are. Radical acceptance. Not becoming a doormat necessarily. Not at all becoming a doormat. Radically accepting. Once we've fully accepted something, we can move on to decide if we want to try to modify it. Yes, the neighborhood has become shishi, although less shishi in the last few months, I have to say. Before 9 months ago, very shishi. And yes, it has become crime-ridden in the last year, really crime-ridden. I talked to you about that before, and I feel sad about that. But instead of complaining, maybe I can do something to try to make it more livable. Maybe I can. I'm an adult. Maybe I can do that. Radical acceptance. In a way, that term, though, it's insufficient to express the warmth, the calm and glow that we can feel when we're just with what is. Just with what is. Just accepting it, but not accepting it. Just hugging it, because it's more than accepting it. It's what is. Why don't you give it a hug? It's what is. Of course, we have the inner tyrant, the inner critic. It isn't good at radical acceptance, right? Not good at radical acceptance. So we need, especially the teaching that comes out of our tradition, Dogen talks about himself, of cultivating and expressing parental mind, grandmotherly mind. So I co-led Rahatsu Sesshin just recently with Ted. Someone came in to see me for a one-to-one, a Doksan toward the end, and she said she was really discouraged. Because all week, rather than steeping in silence, she'd been steeping in constantly churning, constantly chattering mind. Anybody have that experience during retreat? Oh, retreat. And then you get more and more churning and shattering and churning and shattering. You think, what kind of retreat is this? Right? Kind of, I went back to work and I used to go back to work. I'm retired and they asked me how my retreat was. And I say, well, this is a different kind of retreat. They say, was it relaxing? Was there a spa? I said, yeah, well, not exactly. Exactly. Our retreats are a little different. A little different. So she said to me, my worries, my moods, my regrets, my heartaches, just cycling over and over. And sometimes that's all we experience in our meditation. Our thoughts come so fast, they trip over each other. If we do get a moment of quiet, it's fleeting, it's tentative. And then we're back to chatter, chatter, chatter. And then we get discouraged and we think, oh, is this worth our effort? But can we feel the underlying fear below our mental noise? Can we do that? Can we see how that chatter, chatter, chatter covers up those emotions? Can we experience our deepest hurts, our deepest longings, and the existential pain? Pain of just being alive in a direct and undiluted way. Can we just be with that? Our thoughts spin around and around, binding us to the wheel of reacting, regretting, and rehearsing, reacting, and regretting, and rehearsing, in case you haven't noticed. But if you're a meditator, you've noticed. You have noticed. And that wheel, generally, whether we're conscious of it or not, becomes the driving force of our life. And it cuts us off from our genuine interconnected nature. And as Charlotte Beck said, as Joko Beck said, we live a substitute life. Yes, most of us live substitute lives. But Zen practice is about discovering an authentic life below that substitute life. When we just see our persistent thoughts without engaging them or indulging them, good. Eventually the thoughts become transparent to us and we begin to see the fears from which they arise, as well as the related sensations in our body. Instead of getting distracted by the content of the thought dreams, the first time around, you usually know the content. Why do you have to do it 33 times? You've got the content. But instead of getting distracted by the content, instead experience the context. What's the emotional environment? Is it fear? Is it frustration? Is it worry? The churning mind can become our teacher if we just sit with it. It can reveal all kinds of fixations and patterns. We just be with it, just be with it, just be with it. Moment by moment, cultivation of mental clarity gives us courage and inner strength that we didn't realize we have. And as our practice continues, we sometimes get an elusive and indistinct sense that something important is happening in here. It's significant. I can't exactly, it's just out of reach, but it's something important, like vague shapes just beyond the horizon of our awareness. Our inner eye begins to adjust to the dark and to the sensation-based language of our inner teachers. This multiplicity of inner teachers. Who are not necessarily verbal. Oh, sometimes they're verbal, but not. They're deeper than verbal, deeper than verbal. Instead of getting distracted by the content of our thought dreams, can we look instead at the context? See, feel those vague shapes just beyond the horizon of our awareness. And our inner eye adjusts to the dark and to the sensation-based language of our inner teachers little by little. It does, little by little. If you do the practice, you'll find that out, little by little. Or maybe not at all, and then all of a sudden, and then not at all, and all of a sudden. It's its own rhythm. Its own rhythm. The little Tim can't interfere with that. He can try to interfere with that rhythm, but he can't. So as I said at the beginning, the title of my talk is Revisioning Memories to Settle into a Deep Happiness. It's not of time. It's here always, not of time. Not affected by time. Not at all affected by what's happening with Donald Trump or Joseph Biden or our crime in the neighborhood. Not affected by that. Right here. Not affected by that. Revisioning memories differs from simply dwelling on them. It's re-perceiving and not getting mired or trapped in the memories. Interpreting in a new way the things that happened to correct the faulty understandings that led to the negative ideas that we still have. I don't know how well you know your inner tyrant or your inner critic. And you may just have a small one, or you may not have much of one at all, but most people do. But what is that? That inner tyrant, that inner critic is made up of congealed ideas that you have from, I'm just saying this arbitrarily, before you were 25 years old. They congealed into your inner critic or inner tyrant that's trying to protect you, trying to protect you. The brain doesn't fully develop until we're 25. When I read that a few years ago, I thought, yikes, look at all this stuff I did. Before I was 25 and my brain wasn't even fully developed. Boy. But when we're young, we couldn't possibly have understood accurately the deepest meaning of bad things that happened, of difficult things that happened. We couldn't help but feel responsible for negative events that often had little or nothing to do with us. We were little people and there were all these big people around us and they pointed to us indirectly or indirectly and we thought it was our fault. But they were the big ones. How could it have been our fault when they were the big ones and we were the little ones? So often these things that we feel responsible for and that make up our inner critic, our inner child, our inner tyrant, excuse me, not our inner child, our inner tyrant, are just this made up stuff from our childhood that just congeals and stays congealed and punishing, always punishing ourselves, always wanting to punish ourselves. So I worked with a student for a while who at one point she said, well, she had a memory of her when she went into her kind of feel her inner critic, feel her inner tyrant. She had a memory of being sent to her room when she was a kid. And she was sent to her room, timed out, facing the wall when she was overheard swearing. And she thought it was her fault. And she thought she was bad. But you know, when we talked about it more, where did she learn to swear? She overheard her parents swearing. They didn't think she was around and they swore. So she was just imitating their behavior, but she was a bad person. She had to sit in the room. So as a grown up, as a Zen meditator, she has irrational feelings about not being good enough, especially when she's around profanity. She's ashamed. She won't say it herself. When other people, she and I were talking about HBO a while ago. I never watched HBO, but my son came over and had me start watching HBO. F-bombs in every other sentence we watched four HBO series. And I thought, boy, things are different than when I was a kid. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. That's neither here nor there. We internalize the stuff that we're not responsible for, congeals into this inner critic, this inner tyrant that is merciless. It's merciless. So can we review our past to discover just where these beliefs originated? Can we realize that it was our parents or some other caretaker's fault, if it was anybody's fault at all, not ours, that the self-doubt that we haul around was not our responsibility, it was the big people's responsibility? Can we do this without blaming the big people? You know, they had their karma too. Karma gets passed on. So let's not blame them, but let's not take it on ourselves. They were the ones who were fixated on us behaving in a certain way. And we blamed ourselves for being sent to our rooms. I never got sent to my room, by the way. My parents didn't do that. Sometimes this is all inadvertent on the parents' part, on the caretaker's part. My parents were, I had good parents till I got into Zen, but that's another. My parents were really with me till I started doing something really weird. But for the first 20 years, they were really with me. They didn't give me overt negative messages about anything. So I was lucky, so much more lucky than many people. But unconsciously, they gave me messages with their body, with their sensations, with the way they looked at me. And kids are not dumb. We pick that stuff up. We internalize that stuff. And I, as you've heard me say many times, I was a gifted child. At 3 years old, my mother rushed to the Berkeley something center to get my IQ tested. Ran home saying, "You're a gifted child," telling my father I was a gifted child. But, and that's wonderful. They treated me like a gifted child. They loved me. They gave special school, special stuff. But I got to a certain age. How was a gifted child supposed to perform? I didn't know anymore. And my parents had given me subtle messages that I needed to be a gifted child. This is the other part of Ted's talk yesterday. Naming sometimes is very constricting. It congeals us. I was so constricted by this that you've heard me say this before several times. When in seventh grade, I got my bad report card, and it's not bad by normal standards. I think I got one C or maybe one C plus. And I thought, oh no, I'm going to kill myself. So I rode my bike to the President Hotel in Palo Alto, and I ran up four flights of stairs, and I looked out and I thought, yikes, I'm not doing that. I looked all the way down. I'm not doing that. And I ran back and got in my bike. But these naming, this is how the inner tyrant, this is how the inner child, not the inner child again, the inner critic develops. This naming, this congealing of this naming, stuff that wasn't our fault, that came from our environment. And here we carry it around for 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, 60 years until we die. Sometimes old people seem to carry this stuff around more, in case you haven't noticed. They're less in touch with just what is. That's sad, isn't it? But we have our practice. We have our practice. The inner tyrant is always based by biases against ourselves that are unfavorable and out of date, and we can reevaluate them. Back then, we had little choice but to go along. I was a gifted child. Wow. My sister was jealous, but my sister never rode her bike to the President Hotel to try to kill herself. Right? I was caught. I was stuck. And so I cheated my way through school, through adolescence, because Not being the best student was a form of failure. So I began in something like the, I think it was the fifth or sixth grade. We had the more books you read and the more book reports you read, the better you were in the class. So I began writing fake book reports. I would get books and I would spend 5 minutes reading them, and I'm pretty good at scanning. I could write a fake book report. I started doing that in the fifth grade. I did that all through my adolescence. I got halfway through Stanford doing that kind of thing. My goodness. Oh, I feel sad. Don't you feel sad about what we've done to ourselves, what our culture has done to us, and what we've done to ourselves as a result? If acceptance from our family was conditioned, even though my parents thought they were doing unconditioned. My mother was a psychology at major at Stanford, and my dad was at Stanford too. So they did everything unconditioned. They knew about it. I remember my mother preaching about unconditioned love, but you know, she had her own inadequacies. She had her own needs. And so it wasn't unconditioned. It was based on these conditions because she felt so insecure herself, right? No need to blame her. She felt very insecure. If acceptance from our family is conditioned, we forfeit the parts of ourselves that we don't like, that aren't okay. To win the big people's love and to win the big people's support, we disown these parts of ourselves to align with our caretaker's evaluations. When someone was talking to me a while ago about sabotaging their chances of success now and realizing the reason they do that is because they grew up with a parent who found ways of whenever they did something better than the parent, dissing them. So the child realizes that, being really successful is not okay. It's not okay. Failing is a way to be successful. And then as an adult, this person I was meeting with the other week, you know, she's 50 and she's just coming to this realization. It's never too late. She's just noticing this now. She's breathing into it in her meditation. She's getting support for the three-legged stool. Good for her. It's never too late. Unconsciously, we've been tripping ourselves up over and over and over again. Now it's time to do a history rewrite, but not on the conscious level, remember? A little bit on the conscious level. Sure, some on the conscious level, but mainly through our zazen and depending on the three pillars of our stool, right? So for 5 years, when I lived in northern Minnesota, I had I meditated a lot, but my stool only had two legs. It had a leg of Sangha. My best friend and I sat every day. Two people's enough for Sangha. And it had the leg of Dharma because I read over and over some of my teacher's sayings and books, but I had no leg of a teacher. So when I came down here to Minnesota, finally I had the three legs again. Oh, my practice really deepened. My commitment, my aspiration really deepened. So maybe it was our caretaker's shortcomings, or maybe we were neglected or abused environmentally in some other way. It may not have been our caretaker. Some other way. But we can now revise those unfavorable conclusions about ourselves, right? First, we have to be aware of them. Sit with them. Feel the feelings. Then we can revise them. They revise themselves with the help from the three-legged stool and our zazen. So I've been doing guided meditation with people for on and off for many years, helping them find in their own memory a place of safety, and then becoming aware of their emotionally neglectful or abusive things that adults said or did to them and how they're still stuck in their craw, helping them change the flawed, self-disparaging interpretations through guided meditation. I've been supporting folks mentally return to childhood to discover whether their caretakers were overly critical of them, whether they held them to unrealistically high or exaggerated standards. Also, surprisingly, when I do this with people, they find good memories, even with their inadequate caretakers. Your caretaker was doing the best she or she could, and you have some good memories in there, but often they're hidden under the toxic ones. But you can find them. You can find them with some support. There were times when in your childhood you felt safe, you felt connected, you felt part of something larger. So our job as meditators, as Zen practitioners, is to reduce these negative self-judgments, not by running away from them, but just by kindly holding them, kindly breathing through them, and so that we can begin to comfort our inner child. The little guy, the little Tim in here, who still really needy, and the inner tyrant takes over, telling him how to shape up or ship out, right? Shape or ship out. So that little guy, for me a guy, that little guy. So I began many years ago when I first had to give my Dharma talk at Zen Center. I talked about this. The inner tyrant would come in. It would come in and start, hey, oh God, you can't, only Katagiri can do this. I don't know why he's asking you to do this. You don't know anything, and you know this knowledge, but you can't do it. And then I gave a talk, and before the talk, I'd be kind of quaking. And somebody said, oh, is that your Zen practice that makes you quake? And I said, well, I didn't want to tell them, somebody from the outside. I said, no, I just drank some more coffee, some extra coffee. They said, oh, well, cut out the coffee. But really, it was the Dharma talk I had to give that morning, right? So I began on my own mantra. Nice boy, Tim. Nice boy. Nice boy. Nice boy, Tim. Nice boy. Anytime the inner tyrant, the inner critic would grab, nice boy, Tim. So I did that. I did that over and over. This practice you do over and over. This practice takes two things only, patience and persistence. The second and third paramitas, nothing else. Patience and persistence, persistence and patience, patience and persistence, persistence and patience. Nice boy, Tim. Nice boy. When I said that to people, they say, well, it's like you had your dog. Okay. Okay, my dog. Nice boy. My mantra, that's my simplest. Mantras do not have to be complicated, you guys. Gathas do not have to be complicated. Keep them simple. Keep them simple. So that the edges that surround the congealed inner tyrant, the congealed inner critic, begin to soften and open. Soften and open. When this happens, we no longer have to abide by unjustified expectations that we have of ourselves, which others had of us. We can finally breathe deeply. We can stop putting ourselves down for falling short. We all fall short. We can radically accept, but not some intellectual thing, radically embrace what is our own suffering and the suffering of our friend and our parent and our child, whoever it is. when we notice the discouraging, the disapproving, the disparaging coming in, we can just say to ourselves, those were imposed on us. They were imposed on us. They're not our responsibility. And take a nice deep breath, or maybe 32 nice deep breaths, and they'll fall away. They fall away. I know you want them to fall away like this. Sorry. Second and third paramita, or excuse me, third and fourth, patience and persistence, patience and persistence, patience and persistence. So, this practice is a reassessment and a revision, which takes place beyond the limitations of our conscious mind, but includes our conscious mind, of the chronic doubts that we have about our competence. How can I get along not being the best person in the class? My mother told me at 4 I was destined to be the best person. And that lasted for 6 months till someone else in kindergarten did something better than me. And I didn't go home and say, Mommy, you're wrong. I'm the best, but I'm also the worst. I knew I was supposed to perform. I was supposed to be the best. She told me that. She didn't say supposed. To. She said, you are, which is even worse in a way. Even worse. You're the worst person. My sister was the worst person, but we won't get into that. So we have these negative, unsupportive self-beliefs. They're fabrications, but they've been going on for so many years. And they made such perfect sense as a child. We felt we were responsible for all what these big people were doing to us. But they were the big ones. And when we settle in, just settle into it, just be with it, just let it all pass through us, then we discover a deep abiding happiness. That's not limited to our bodies. That's not limited to environment. It's right here. It's always here. And you may just get a taste of that for a minute. That's okay. That can be your aspiration. That momentary taste can be your aspiration to do this practice with even more vigor, with even more aspiration. So that you can become your inner child's parent. You can. You become your inner child's parent. Your original mother or father or other authority can no longer hurt you or humiliate you. Your inner tyrant can. Your inner critic can. But you can be your own inner child's parent. Wow. Wow. Isn't that lucky? You can do that. Good memories can become predominant. So your spiritual aspirations become more alive. As long as you are just totally dominated by the inner tyrant, your aspiration is limited. And you get into a funk so easily. But I want to tell you a secret. It's safe to aspire to do your personal best. And you do that by giving yourself a box seat in your own cheering section. Giving yourself a box seat in your own cheering section. That's my secret. That's my secret. Once we locate the origins of a pattern of fear, we have a challenge. The challenge is, can we remind ourselves that we've got a lot more resources now than we did then? That fear comes from them, and now we have these resources. Now we have Zazen. Now we've got the three-legged stool. And if one of those legs is a little wobbly, then reinforce it. If you haven't been reading your favorite book about that inspires your Dharma practice, pick it up again. don't try to get more knowledge. The Dharma stool isn't trying to get more knowledge. You have enough knowledge. Just come back to those books, to those teachings, to those Dharma talks that really help you, that really help you. Go into them again. Go through them again. Once we locate these origins of this pattern, we have a possibility to crack open to heart and mind, which is already here, always here. Chitta in Sanskrit, heart and mind. What once happened to us was something that had to happen. Things happen the way they needed to happen. You know, you want to say that you wish they happened differently. Tough. This is the way they happen. It had to happen that way because that's the way it happened. Given our level of development back then, we blamed ourselves for the things the big people told us we were bad at doing. We blamed ourselves. And maybe we had to do that through our 20s and 30s and 40s. But now that we're practicing, do we still need to do that? Now that we're really aspiring through our meditation and use of the three-legged stool, do we still need to do that? What once happened to us had to happen. And we say to ourselves in Saturday and Tuesday, all the karma ever created by me, I now fully avow. But you know, I say it differently. I add something. I say, all the karma ever created by my life, I now fully avow. Because as kids, it was our circumstances that created this. We had very little power. And even as fragile adults, when we were mixed up and driven by the inner tyrant, even by middle-aged adults. So rather, it's all the karma ever created by my life, by my circumstances, by my environment. Just me. When we say just me, we're congealing the inner tyrant again. We're giving the inner critic more power again. But karma really means that everything is the cause and the effect of everything else. That's my definition of karma. Everything is the cause and the effect of everything else. So don't congeal it into this inner critic or even the outer critic. I could go into the outer critic, but narcissistic people seem like they don't have an inner critic. They only have outer critics, but actually they do have an inner critic. They're just not even aware of it, but I'm not going to get, that's just a psychology lecture. I'm not going down there. Of course, this is all kind of psychology too, isn't it? So forgiving ourselves and forgiving those in the past who caused us this pain, they had their own karma. They had their own difficulties. Letting go of these earlier hurts and disappointments, but can't do it so much consciously. Revisioning our past, we can do. We can make peace with it finally. Finally, we can, but we have to see the thoughts and feel the feelings to make peace with it. And we can make a promise to ourselves to give ourselves the support, love, and caring we seldom received as a kid. Or we didn't receive enough of. I actually received lots of it, but there was this undercurrent. Undercurrent. It must have been my parents' own insecurity about not being the best themselves, although actually they were almost the best. But I come from this really weird family. Of course, we all come from really weird families. So they're just families. You know, we have this expression as psychologists. Oh, I worked with another dysfunctional family. Oh, I worked with another dysfunctional family. Oh, my family is dysfunctional. So what's dysfunctional mean? It's an extra word. They're all just families. We're all just trying to get along as best we can. We're all just getting along as best we can. So the inner tyrant begins to recede. As we do this, and there's a, our relationships become warmer and more fulfilling because we're more warmer and fulfilling in here. The child didn't understand, hadn't learned, but our revision helps us move past the child's conditioning, the internal tyrant's conditioning, and the defenses that we developed, the denial, the repression, the projection to self-safeguard ego. But we misidentify ego as self. Self is much bigger and broader and loving than ego. We work so hard to keep these parts of ourselves hidden, but they undermine our day-to-day functioning. As Bob Dylan said, if my thought dreams were to be seen, they'd put my mind in a guillotine. True for all of us. Can we meet our fears and defenses with compassion? We don't need to depend on denial, repression, and projection to distract us from our worrisome thoughts and feelings. We can create a space to allow them in to heart mind, and then we radiate out love and compassion. We can step back from regretting and rehearsing and regretting and rehearsing and feel a world, even in this world, which seems so out of kilter, which is much bigger and much warmer than we'd imagined. Can we see that wheel of reactivity without judgment, beginning to disidentify with it, not trying to disidentify with it, but just steeping ourselves and sitting quietly and being aware with our three-legged stool and the third and fourth paramitas, putting the tea bag into the hot water over and over again, getting our butt on the cushion over and over again. The flavor of the water changes. The aroma of the water changes. Little by little, sweetness bubbles up. Right in the middle of your churning mind, sweetness bubbles up. Regardless of the speed of your churning mind, heart mind is here, waiting for you to tap into it. Happiness is waiting to burst out. Happiness is waiting to burst out. Happiness is waiting to burst out. That's what I want to say this morning. That's what I want to say.